We're actually live and going crazy, totally disorganized here. For those of you who are listening at home, we're actually in an auditorium today with a group of people at the Online News Association. And I'm here with my usual partner in crime, Jay Rosen. Jay, would you like to say hello to everybody?
Hi, welcome to everybody. Thanks for coming to our live session of Rebooting.
May I make a suggestion
before
we start? Close the Blog Talk Radio window. Because otherwise you'll hear everything we say.
I don't even know where I have
it. Delayed.
Yes, I do, and it is on.
We've had our share of glitches here today, but I'd like to prove that we actually have an audience. Would everybody cheer, please? Yeah! All right. So this is a first, for me at least, first time I've ever done this podcast in front of an audience. Jay did one session.
I did.
Last year at the Online News Association.
Right. And what we thought we would do in this program is run through, at the beginning, a few of the major themes of our show. We've done this podcast for 70 weeks. And in that time, certain themes have emerged that we continue to come back to because they seem basic to what we call the rebooted system of news. And we're going to mention a few of them. Maybe a few of them we'll have to explain, but we don't want to spend too long on them because if we do that, we'll actually use up the entire podcast. So let me just run down some of these things so that you understand some of the master narratives or obsessions that Dave and I have explored through the 70 weeks that we've been doing this. The first is, we're already using the rebooted system of news. It's not something that's coming. It's not something on the horizon.
Right.
It's already here. And so by redescribing what is already here, we can see what's different about the system of news.
In other words, people are already getting news through a new system at this point.
Right.
It's not the same old system. While the old system is still in place, we're actually doing something new. Right?
Yes. Yeah. And in that new system, every node in the network is a news node, a participant in the network. And, of course, the easiest way to see that is through the Twitter network, right, where every user is a potential source of news. But that is one of the features of the rebooted system of news. Every node in the network is a potential source of news. A third is a sentence Dave came up with a while ago that I think really describes what's something different about the news world we're in, which is the sources go direct. Why don't you explain what that means a little bit?
Well, it's the same thing that the internet does to everything that it touches. It's called disintermediation, which is a long word with a lot of syllables. What it means is we're going to take out the intermediaries. And that's what the internet enables. So, for example, I had to book a train trip this afternoon. I didn't call a travel agent, but 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I probably would have had to have called a travel agent. And the reason why was very simple. They were the only ones that had access to the computers that did the reservations. But what's changed now is that everybody has access to those computers. And so similarly, in the news business, the component of news are basically sources. And those sources have access to publishing systems. In the past, the thing that the reporters in the news industry had that was special were access to the publishing systems. So now the sources, if they feel the story isn't getting out there the way they want it to get out there, and that's actually a fairly common theme that you hear from sources, they can just go ahead and publish it themselves. So that's what sources go direct means.
Yes, and probably the most famous words ever written about freedom of the press are, Congress shall make no law, but the second most famous words about freedom of the press are freedom of the press belongs to those who own one.
And or don't pick a fight with people who buy ink by the barrel.
Ink by the barrel. But if freedom of the press belongs to those who own one, what the rebooted system of news means is everyone owns one.
Right.
And one of the reasons I'm doing this podcast with you is that you've actually created some of the tools that made that the case. Podcasting, blogging tools, RSS, etc. Another theme of our show is something I've written a lot about in my blog. It's easier to trust, here's where I'm coming from, than the view from nowhere. And what I mean by this is that the system of trust is actually shifting in the rebooted system of news. And now, because people can know so much more, not only from news sources, but about the sources of news that they trust, it's a lot easier for people to trust a news provider who says to us, here's where I'm coming from. Here's what my values are. Here's what my perspective is. Here's my background. Here are my qualifications.
This one really rubs reporters the wrong way. I mean, and this is a debate that we don't understand. I'm speaking for both of us, actually, is that why is it that reporters don't want to tell you what they believe? And the answer you get back is that they believe that there is such a thing as impartiality or objectivity. But one of the basic tenets of the rebooted news system is we don't believe that. And if you ask people, ordinary people, if they believe that there is such a thing as objectivity, you'll find that they don't. Is there a problem with
this? Too low?
Like, you just need, we don't mind showing the scene.
Like
here.
That? Is that better?
Yeah. It's.
I don't have anything to attach it to.
Maybe like that. Is that better?
That sounds pretty clear. Can we move on? Is there okay?
Okay.
You were
thank
saying
you.
Jay before.
Yes. So what journalists traditionally believe is that the mask of impartiality is what allows people to trust them. But increasingly, that is not so.
And Ken Kaufman had was the best line I've ever heard about this. Which was objectivity and impartiality are journalism's version of don't ask, don't tell. I thought it was like about the most concise, brilliant, direct way of saying what I believe is true.
So. Well, part of the reason why I think we can now say here's where I'm coming from is that the web allows us the space to do that. And before it was really hard to do
right.
that. But now we can
How
go to your page and
news,
find out
right.
about you.
How could you stop a news broadcast and say, by the way, I voted Democratic last year. But
yes. Right? And here's another theme that we have repeatedly come back to, that it's dangerous for the news industry to rely on the tech industry for its next generation of tools and platforms.
Do you believe that, Jay?
Well, I believe it's from listening to you.
Right. I've been working on Jay for years because there is a tendency to believe that the tech industry is the source of a lot of wisdom. I mean, if you look at how journalism has covered tech, and I've been in the tech business almost 30 years, I guess, maybe even more. And journalism covers tech icons, tech leaders, as if they were messiahs, you know, as if they were people who had been to the mountaintop and had received the truth, when that really isn't what's going on. I think there's a tendency to want to believe that somebody really understands where we're going here. And as a result, the tech industry has taken huge advantage of this situation, as you would expect almost anyone to do. You know, if you go to somebody and say, well, you tell me how the world works, I trust you implicitly with my future, you got to believe that they're going to have a program for you, something for you to do. I have shaken my head many, many times watching the news industry just sit on the sidelines and let the tech industry own the valuable systems that are the news, what I believe and what people have come to believe will be the news system of the future. The latest iteration of that is Twitter. If I were running, you know, a major news organization, I guess I would have to use Twitter at this point, but I would be actively trying to figure out how to get out of being dependent on them. If you watch, and that's just example, one tech company But if you watch how they've morphed that service over what the years, the few years that they've been alive, you've seen that it's getting to be a less and less friendly place for other corporations, for other elements of media industry. And it's only going to get more so. And the thing you don't want to find out one day is that, you know, they've bought one of your competitors and now you're illegal on Twitter.
I just saw today that Twitter sent out instructions for the proper use of the terms Twitter and tweet, and an attempt to almost trademark the word tweet with a capital T.
Well, they believe that that
they
is
believe
a
it
trademark.
Is their
Absolutely.
Trademark. So that's an example of what you're saying. But part of the reason why this happens, Dave, is that the news industry was, for a very unusually long period of time, a monopoly industry where if you simply did exactly what you did the year before, you did well. And that kind of business doesn't actually attract people who want to venture a new idea, who are capable of disrupting and reinventing.
I actually disagree. I met some of those people in 1994 when I was working on the strike paper for the San Francisco newspapers. Some of those people that were working for the newspapers back in those days were teaching me how the web works and why links were so important. These were people who had a great vision for the future. The thing that happened, which if you think about it, you'd expect, is that they left. You know, when the rest of their industry wasn't going along with it, it attracted, you're right, I'm not saying that you're wrong, it does attract the kinds of people who don't accept change, but it also attracted some truly innovative people. But they left, yeah, as you would expect them to.
Well, the culture of the news industry is a killer in that sense.
Yeah.
Another theme that we've talked about a lot is this kind of cycle in technology that happens where open systems create certain problems by the nature of their openness. And what happens is innovators come along to solve those problems and take us away from the messiness and chaos of open systems. And they create these very attractive, beautiful, closed platforms to solve the problems of openness. And then the weaknesses and disadvantages of the closed platforms build up, and someone else comes along to disrupt them by creating more open systems. And the cycle starts again. And this is something you've seen in your career,
Dave. And every time it happens, people think it's the first time it ever happened. And it's funny to see that.
And the iPad would be an example of that happening right now. Magazines,
I suppose,
on the iPad are attempting to solve the chaos and misery and difficulty.
You never know. You really don't ever know until you're ready to write the history of it, until the cycle is closed. Maybe tablet computers don't have a future. You know, the jury, although I own an iPad and I love it, and it's so I'm not questioning it on a personal level. You know, and I was very skeptical about it when it first came out. We don't really know for sure that tablets are the next wave, but if they are, you're right that the making it extremely simple, you know, one size fits all. You don't have to make a lot of choices. That's very important to get one of these things.
What we also know is that there is a wish, a hope, that the iPad can deliver a magic solution to the news industry.
And that's, to forgive the term, that's BS.
Interesting.
That ain't going to happen. That's a fairy tale. Bedtime story. That's Uncle Steve having come visit the New York Times and promised them that he would do that for them. And when Steve promises he'll do something for you, I would count the change. Count your fingers, too.
Here's a problem that's really interested me in the new system of news. We serve you the updates without the background necessary to make sense of those updates.
Where did this one come from?
This is something that I've been talking a lot about on the show, and I put it in just before we started.
I don't remember this one, Jay.
That's because you're not concentrating hard enough on what I'm saying.
He's a professor, by the way. You have to put up with it.
The news system was built to deliver us a constant series of news stories about what's new today.
Right. Oh, I see what you're
saying. It is a stream of updates.
Right.
And it always was weak on something else we need to actually understand the news, which is the background knowledge necessary to grasp the issue, problem, context of an updated stream of news. And most people actually come in the middle of big ongoing stories like the BP oil spill or the mortgage crisis or other sort of complicated stories that go on for years. And in the past, we had no way to solve this problem of how do we deliver the background necessary to understand why the news stories are actually news and why we keep hearing about them. But in the rebooted system, in the system that we have now that we're already using, as we said earlier, we can actually solve this problem. We should be able to provide you with the full context, the story up to now, in addition to the updates to that story. And how to provide both of those things at the same time is, to my mind, a major design problem and journalistic challenge in the rebooted system.
I think it's actually not a huge challenge, just you have to have the will to do it. I mean, there's an infinite number of places on the web, right? So
right.
You can put it any number of different places. You just have to decide that that's something. I think that in the back of our minds, we all are nagged by this one. You know, that you realize you're making a contribution to something that's ongoing, but we haven't yet figured out how to deposit that in a way that you can then find it again later.
Yeah, and Google may try to at least make a start on it with its Living Stories experiment, but that didn't go very far. But it's sort of an unsolved problem, even though it's solvable.
Right.
People come back. I love this sentence. It's something that Dave wrote years ago. People come back to places that send them away. I wish the news industry understood this.
Yeah.
People come back to places that send them away.
I wish the tech industry understood this one, too, even though the tech industry has been the moments of almost renaissance when this has actually happened have been enormously successful and formative and for the tech industry. Google, for example, is a perfect example of...
Because
you go to Google, right? You type in a phrase, and it sends you to 8,000 different places. It's not keeping you on Google.
And nobody at Google says, oh, they're leaving our domain.
Well, I bet they do. I bet they do. They just don't win the arguments. You know, they haven't yet won those arguments. You can see Google fighting this battle inside of itself all the time. They are not of one mind about this one. But a great example of this was Yahoo. This is about news. When RSS was first sort of really exploding, I had access to the major aggregators, the major portals, because they were interested in RSS and they wanted, if I knocked on the door, they would talk to me. And Yahoo in 2004 was totally winning the war with MSN and CNN. And they had all gone from being roughly equal. Yahoo had, in the space of about a year, doubled in size. So they had, and that's, obviously a very significant thing. And that was the difference. The difference was because they were aggregating news not just from Yahoo.com, but from CNN and Reuters and every other news source. So you'd end up in this weird situation is where would you go to find out what was new on CNN? Yahoo, of course, right? No, nobody thinks that way, but that was the pattern that was developing. The people at Yahoo that were responsible for this idea told me what a hard sell it was for inside the organization. And that closed quickly. They didn't do that again, even though it worked incredibly well for them. It's, in a way, for the old news way of thinking about news, it's counterintuitive that sending people away is a way to get them to come back. But that's how the internet user works. That's if you learn that Google is a good way to find the stuff you're looking for, you're going to keep coming back to it.
And this is why I always chuckle when I hear people from the news industry complaining about aggregators, because...
Yeah.
They actually didn't want to own and dominate.
But they should have been aggregators. They should have been aggregators.
They didn't want to be aggregators.
I know, but they
and they still don't want to be. Because
they could still do it.
Now they're changing all their links to refer to their own internal pages rather than to link out to the rest of the world. And it seems like they had ample opportunity to learn this lesson. And if they don't want to, it's because they actually are choosing not.
I think when you look at it from the future, from the point of view of the future, I think that what's happening there is they're trying to use the current tools to win the old battle. The old battle was how to sell more newspapers. So the keeping people within your borders is analogous to selling more newspapers.
Or page views. But did you notice that Nick Denton, whose moves I always pay attention to, the head of Gawker, when you know he built this board for his people at Gawker where they can watch live how the various posts they have up today are doing on the web. And originally it tracked hits or traffic to Gawker posts throughout the Gawker empire, all their sites on one board. And now he's changed it. It doesn't count hits anymore. It counts new, unique visitors coming to the Gawker domain and which posts today, right now, are drawing the most new visitors to the domain, because his view is that's a much better measure of how a post is actually doing, which is kind of interesting. We're going to go to people in the audience soon. So we have somebody with a mic who can help us out,
that's
right?
That's Megan, I think. So yeah. Megan, would you raise your hand?
So raise your hand.
And everybody knows.
If you want to contribute, just let us know. But right. We're going to...
But the rule is keep it short, you know. But it's not just questions. A lot of sessions, they only allow you to ask questions. That's not what we're doing here.
You're free to make statements.
What we learned was that people would ask questions but mask them, you know, or would make statements but mask them as questions. Like, do you believe that? And then go on and make their speech. So you're allowed to make little speeches, very little ones.
The other day you wrote at your blog, Dave, the enemy of progress is complexity.
Yeah.
And that would seem to prevail within new systems as well. So what does that mean?
It's observable. I mean, you only get to create so much complexity before it's – I'm not sure. Should I tell – I mean, the story – how can I tell the story quickly? This is how it works in tech. When I came up in the 70s, I could have gone to work for a mainframe or mini computer company, and I could have gotten on their ladder, and I would have had to have mastered all kinds of things that were very complicated. And so my choice was to go climb that ladder or create something completely new that didn't require any ladder climbing. That basically, I could start from the ground floor, and my knowledge would be roughly the same as everybody else's. And the people that were in the mini computer business at the time probably felt like they were pretty safe because they had mastered all of this complexity, and anybody that was going to catch them would have to also master it, and they would always stay a few steps ahead of them. So instead, I got myself a what was called a CPM computer, and then I got myself an Apple II. These were all very bare-bones computers that had almost no software on them at all. And we went and showed our products to the people in the mainframe business, and they laughed at them. They said, well, these are toys. And that they were, I guess, much simpler than what they were selling, but they ended up kicking their asses. So I don't know if I've explained how complexity is the enemy of progress, but it's certainly, if they had worked at keeping things simple, then they might have had a few more years of a run. But it happens all the time. It's happened recently to XML. The young kids coming up didn't like all the crap that had been piled on top of XML. So now if you want to exchange data between applications on the internet, you have to know JSON. JSON is a simpler language, but when they have all the features of XML, guess what? It'll be just as complicated. And what will happen is some other group of kids 5 years from now will come along and reinvent JSON. So progress happens. You make this much progress, right? Then you start over, and then somebody comes along and redoes it. So reinvention happens sooner, the more complicated it is.
All right.
Did I do that?
That's good enough.
That work?
Okay. Who wants to start with a question, comment, or observation? Tell us who you are.
Hi, I'm Hari. How would you reboot midterm election coverage?
Wow, that's really specific. I don't know.
Well,
I'm not watching the midterm election coverage.
back in the 90s, the civic journalism movement, pre-web, not citizen journalism, but civic journalism, came up with an answer to that, which the journalism profession has more or less rejected, but it is a good solution. And civic journalism, earlier in this conference, was called messianic by Eric Wemple, if you were there, which I really enjoyed. But here was the messianic idea that we came up with in 1992 to improve election coverage. It's called the Citizens' Agenda for Election Coverage. It's very simple. You take an individual election, like who's going to be the next senator of Nevada, and as journalists, you go out and you find out, what do the citizens of Nevada want the candidates to be discussing as they decide who to vote for in 2010? What do the citizens of the state want the candidates to be discussing as they decide who to vote for? Not who are you going to vote for or what issues matters most to you, but what do you want the candidates to be discussing? And by inquiring into that in every way you can, from polls to conversations to public forums to call us, write us, email us, using Twitter, using social media, you actually devise a list of the most important things that people want the candidates to be discussing. And you use that agenda, which could be 5, 6, 8, 10 items, as a template for coverage. So when the candidates give a talk, you map what they said against the citizens' agenda. And you develop all the necessary background for people to understand the citizens' agenda. And because you have an agenda, it allows you to not get distracted by the controversy of the day, the latest negative ad, the circus and showmanship that surrounds campaigns. And this solution, which was tried, which was perfected, not perfected, but developed through a series of elections in the 90s, was simply lost to professional memory in journalism because the people who do political reporting actually like the horse race. They want to be part of the inside game. They prefer it that way. So that's how I would reboot elections. But it's not a new idea. It's actually an old idea that the news profession deliberately forgot.
Hi, my name's Lauren. So earlier you talked about journalists saying where they're coming from when they're writing stories and not exactly not being objective, but saying a lot of transparency. Where do you think is the best place for that to be shown in a story or in a broadcast, and how do you let the audience know without stating it out there, like you said, oh, by the way, I'm a Democrat? Or,
well, the simplest is simply to link the byline to a page about that person where you can find out everything you need to know. And on those pages, it would be sort of like home pages for professional journalists, and you would let the individual journalists develop them in a way so that you can get a rounded and full and nuanced picture of where I'm coming from. When I say where I'm coming from, I don't mean simply what party do you belong to and which ideological box can we sort you into. It should be much more human than that. It should be much more nuanced.
And you should change it as you change.
And you should change it as...
If you change, if another issue comes along and all of a sudden you decide the death penalty is bad where you've been supporting the death penalty before, then your profile should reflect that.
And it's not so much that you shouldn't try to be objective in your news coverage. That's not how I put it. What I put it is, instead of saying that you're coming from nowhere, instead of presenting that illusion, go the opposite way. Say, here's where I'm coming from, and here is my report made as truthful and accurate as I can make it. And I just think that that's a more reliable way of building trust today.
It's not even necessarily always about trust. I mean, it also informs the reader
how to read this.
Right.
Yeah.
For example, I wrote a review. This is a MacBook Air. This is the new computer that Apple just came out with. And I am a big fan of netbooks. I don't know if everybody knows what a netbook is. And this is supposed to be a netbook. And so I wrote a review of this, a first look of this product, from the point of view of somebody who loves netbooks. And it would have been a very different review had I never used a netbook and had only used a Macintosh. And in fact, a lot of the people that commented on my review didn't understand that that's where I was coming from, even though I had been very, very clear about that. They expected me to see it the same way that they see it, which is as a Mac fan, you know, this is a new kind of a Mac. Well, that's certainly one way to look at it. But you see a wholly different thing. It's like, you know, the blind man and the elephant, right? If you come at it from the back, you're going to see something very different than if you come at it from the front. So it makes a difference. Where are you coming from? And I think ideally, if you really care about understanding what's actually happening, you want to get a lot of different points of view on something. So the assumption that the view from nowhere, which is a term I first heard from Jay, even exists, denies one of the very most important parts of truth getting on the part of an informed person. You know, I need to hear it from five different points of view before I have a sense of what actually happened there. And as a result, I don't believe you asked about, you know, coverage of elections. I don't watch it because I don't believe anything is actually happening there. And my answer to that question would be is you'll get the answer when we can reboot the political process too. And the next step in that is that once the new system is rebooted, you will have a rebooted political process. Because in this society, the two things are inexorably part of one and the same.
Let's go to the next person.
Well, I think that objectivity is likely to go away for the same reason that it started in the first place, which is economics. It was during a little bit before the Civil War. I think the wire services figured out that if they could sell news to northern sympathizers and southern sympathizers, they could make twice as much money. And the expensive part of news gathering, of course, is sending somebody out there to go find out what's going on, interview people, figure it out. Well, if they had kind of a straight down the middle approach, and then they could make twice as much money. Now, we're seeing American journalism go the way of the French and many other systems where in Paris, if you look at Le Monde, you see sort of a center-right point of view. If you see Combat, that's the Communist Party newspaper, you know immediately where these guys are coming from, literally. I'm an alumni of CNN, and Fox, to my chagrin, is outperforming financially and in terms of audience CNN, which attempts to be or says it's objective. Fox is clearly, when they donate $1 million to Republican causes, is clearly not objective. And they are being very successful financially. I think other news organizations are very, for good or bad, are very likely to follow their example.
Well, objectivity in journalism is actually a very complicated construction. It doesn't have a single point of origin. It doesn't have a single cause. The anecdote you told about the AP is one of them. But what I find hard to communicate to people in the news industry, and I haven't found the right way of doing it yet, is if people don't trust the mask of impartiality, they don't trust it. And it doesn't matter how much you insist on it, they still don't trust it. And there's a sense in which the trust transaction is not completely within your control. You can do things that you think are trustworthy, but if people don't actually trust them, they don't work the way you thought they would. I want to add
something to this.
We
don't believe that sending witnesses is part of the future of news. In other words, that is right there what you said about sending witnesses to observe a battle in the Civil War isn't the way news is going to work or the way news actually works today. What will happen is you'll have reports from witnesses. You don't have to send the witnesses there because the people who are there can witness it. We can hear from them. We don't have a mic on you, though.
I think we should move on.
No, I want to actually...
We're going to get into a very familiar argument. We've done 100 times.
All right.
If you
can
respond,
we talk later? Yeah, he's right. We've been through this a billion
times. I'm telling you, it's a rabbit hole. Let's move on.
We're not going to agree, in other words.
Yeah, it's a rabbit hole.
Yeah, how about that? We can still like each other, right?
Hi, I'm John DiNunzio. I work at Jay's favorite media organization, The Washington Post. One thing you guys say that really resonates with me is about the fact that news companies are wrongheaded to rely on tech companies like we do. So, but I'm not sure where to go. I'm curious if you guys have any general hunches where a good area to explore would be. Reinventing or making an alternative to Twitter, for instance, doesn't make a lot of sense. That'd be really hard competition.
Why?
So what
why
areas
not?
Would you...
Why not?
It's just just my gut that Twitter's so well established that that would be a really hard road to go and to win that battle. But hey, tell me I'm wrong. I'd like to hear why. Then.
You're wrong.
Okay, why?
Well, because we're really, 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 really early in this thing. Okay, I think Twitter is a dress rehearsal for the news system of the future. It is not the news system of the future. I have a database in which I have the last few years of the New York Times RSS content. So I just wrote a script, and I wanted to see what is the length of a description of a New York Times RSS item. In other words, here are people whose profession is news, whose passion is news. These are real, you know, scholars of news. They really care about news, right? Whereas I know that the guys at Twitter don't care about news. Honest to goodness, they really don't. The level at which they care about news is the level at which it can make them richer, really is about what it's about. And they have a very superficial idea of what news is. Well, was it 140 characters? No. It was not 140 characters. So let's just start right there. Why did we decide that that was the perfect length for a news item? Ask some writers. Do you want the limit there at all? I don't want it. I'm a writer myself. I've been writing for many, many years now, and I really work at my craft. I confuse people all the time because of that 140 character limit. I'm fed up with it, right? So, yeah, no, it's just beginning. So the question is, can one create a reliable, by the way, Twitter, is it reliable? I'm still getting fail whales. I don't know about you. But, and the banking industry, for example, has been able to create real-time systems. The airline industry has been able to create real-time systems. All kinds of real-time systems exist that don't have fail whales in them, right? So even at a technology level, this company has not managed to master this thing. So no, when you think it's too late, who told you that? It's intuitive. You sure that? No, Jay, okay, all right. I just want to give him a chance.
That's why I asked.
Yeah, go for it. No, it's not too late.
No. I'm wondering if there are other journalistic conventions that you think don't either make much sense anymore or actually are more destructive than we'd like to think they are. So something I hear a lot from journalists is, you know, how can we tell the best story? And sometimes that might mean that you select a quote that is more provocative, or in some cases you'll profile someone going through a certain experience, and the story itself almost insinuates that they have the average experience. They might be looking at a government process that impacts millions of people, but by putting one person out there, they sort of convey that their experience is representative of everyone. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sort of curious, if you look at the sort of traditional structure of a story itself, if there are other things that you think we can and should rethink given what we have available to us on the web.
Yes, and part of the reason I think so, Amanda, is that the way that journalists compose news accounts now is an artifact of a production routine that emerged from the industrial era of print and, to some degree, broadcast. And in what happens is that over time, these production routines, which are artifacts of particular technology, get reified. That's an academic term. It means they get taken as more important than they are, into what journalists think of as news, right? When actually they're just an artifact of what we were able to produce at the time. And the isolated quote that stands for like a whole category of people is really a reflection of how limited the space and time were, right, to actually examine that body of people. So we could certainly do without that. Another thing we could do without is 1,300 journalists at the scene of the Chilean miners' rescue when I'm pretty sure every single angle could have been covered by 100. And for the news companies to be saying simultaneously, who's going to fund the Baghdad Bureau, people? We need a new economy of news. And to be sending several thousand people to a single story is an example of a convention in news. We need our own person there that is completely outmoded, that we completely could do away with. And I think if we start with the assumption that everything that's routine in newsrooms from before the web was not routine because it's inherent in news, but because of the technology and production demands we had, and if we start with that insight, which I think is a really important one, then we can see like what we need and what we don't need.
I want to add one little thing. No more interviewing other reporters.
Yeah.
I mean, when you put 1,300, was it 1,300? 1,300 reporters there covering Chile. I didn't watch a single minute of this, by the way. But I would have to guess there was a fair amount of reporters interviewing other reporters because there just really wasn't anybody else.
Or how about calling up experts at think tanks and universities so that they can say what you would like to say if only you had freedom to say it in your own news story.
But these are little nitpicks.
We don't need that anymore.
These are tiny little nitpicks because that isn't really what is going on. I mean, I think that let's talk about turning the cup completely upside down, right? In other words, create a news system where everybody in your community can create news that can take what they have observed and report it, okay? Well, we found, you know, I go to Jay's class sometimes, and he gave us a reading assignment. He asked us to read speeches from, 8 different news execs talking about the future of news. The one thing not one of them would even consider was the possibility that what their reporters do might be done by somebody for no pay. They won't even consider it. They won't even think about it. They won't even mention it. It's the unmentionable. Well, I think that you have to start not only thinking about it, but you have to start architecting around that idea, that this is actually going to happen. Now, you're passionate about news and you love news and you want the best thing. You want to take advantage of the system and take news and square it or cube it. Just make it so much better. What can you do if you open this system up to everybody to participate in?
I think there is this fear if people do things for free, there won't be any jobs for journalists. When really what we should be thinking is if people do things for free, then we can move the job of the journalist to something much more value-added. I mean, that's the perspective.
That's nice. That's Jay, because Jay is a journalism professor. He has to say that, okay? But you know what? And I'm tired of coddling journalists. I seriously am. I don't remember reading a single article in any newspaper about the problems that programmers were having as a result of open source software. Yet it completely turned our industry upside down. That didn't put any programmers out of work, by the way. There are more programmers employed today than there were 10 or 15 years ago by orders of magnitude. But the change that it brought for our industry was enormous. Well, I don't want to. I've given at the office. I have already empathized enough with reporters. Now it's time to start acting like adults and start thinking about the future from realistic terms. So, but Jay, it's okay if you keep doing it. I mean, but I'm not going to do it anymore.
The notion that I'm coddling the news industry would be amusing to people.
Well, that's why you put me up here, so that it looks like that.
But I'm into that. We have other...
By the way, you all are doing great. I mean, we were afraid that there might be some attacks or, you know...
I wasn't.
I was. Well, yeah. All right. Okay. So thank you very much for not killing us. Is there someone there?
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. Chris Amico from NewsHour.
Hi, Chris.
Another one of Jay's favorite news organizations.
I have problems with the news hour. Go ahead.
Someday we might actually
get you on TV. Is Jay famous for being problematic with news organizations?
I don't think so. No. I wouldn't call it famous.
Oh, come on. Now we need to give Jay a hug.
Go on. Ask your question.
I'm actually curious about do you – thinking about explicitly partisan media, Fox News, Huffington Post, TPM, people who are doing, in some cases, very good journalism, in some cases, Fox News. I'm sorry.
Is there anybody from Fox News here, by the way? Okay. They're all at the rally.
I'm curious how much you attribute the success, because all of those ones I mentioned have done very well in the past few years, how much you attribute the success to sort of a shared sense of identity that they can have with their audience because they identify with who they are and very much are – they put everything – they put their politics very much out there.
Do you think Fox News is news? Do we need to even talk about this?
Yeah. I mean,
it's entertainment, isn't it? Isn't it something to get your body chemistry – of a certain type of person to go through the roof.
Well, and that's kind of what I'm asking. Like,
it's not really to inform people, is it? Is there any information in there?
I don't know. I actually, to be honest, I don't watch it that much.
Well, here's what
I think. But I know. But I have friends. Question. I have relatives who that is what they watch. I mean, I have family members who like they watch Fox News.
Yeah.
And they watch it as news.
Right.
Whether or not it should be, and I'm curious how much of the success you attribute to sort of the sociological, psychological niche that they fill in creating a shared sense of identity amongst their audience and with themselves.
Yes. Well, first of all, it really annoys me when people who come from the tradition, let's say, of view from nowhere journalism or nonpartisan reporting is the way they would put it, kind of create this category of other and lump in Fox, Huffington Post, Talking Points Memo, and every other sort of ideologically inflected news organization instead of looking carefully at each one and trying to ask, like, what do they do? So in the case of Fox, what I think is distinctive about Fox is not that it's right-wing news, that's part of it, but rather that on Fox, news exists in order to generate controversy. Controversy is the programming strategy, and it's controversy that generates resentment in people, because that's the theme of the controversy is who's worth resenting today.
That's what I said.
It's the resentment.
It's body chemistry.
Yeah.
It's to get you going.
Right. And it's the resentment that drives the ratings. Now, I would attribute the success of Huffington Post mostly to the fact that it was a very successful aggregator. It picked up an opportunity that the news industry did not want, which was to aggregate news from across the web. And that is the traction that began at first, because the blogging platform and 3,000 writers in one place wasn't going to be enough to get that site to take off. It was the aggregation. And every year, the kind of liberal left roots of the Huffington Post become less of a factor in its success because the kinds of verticals they're launching now actually have nothing to do with that. They have a divorce vertical. They do. A travel vertical, food, right, all those things. So that's that site. With Josh Marshall, it's definitely an aspect of his success that a group of people who see politics the way he does gathered around him. But a very important characteristic of that community is that they are constantly sending stuff into him. And he practices a kind of journalism of the inbox by filtering that material that's coming in all the time. That is greatly responsible for the success of his site. So while you can say they're all ideologically inflected, if you look carefully at them, at how they actually operate, very important differences stand out. So each one, I think, has kind of like a different reason why it's successful. But I think about Fox, I think about resentment news.
How are we doing? Wait. I want to ask, how are we doing on time? With 7 minutes left. Okay. Well, can we go over here? Yeah. I think enough Fox News. No, you can't do this. You don't even have a mic, all right?
Okay.
Let's go over here.
Daniel.
So you mentioned earlier open source, right? And a decade or so ago, there's this open source movement where conceivably a lot of programmers are going to be out of jobs because
they weren't put out of jobs.
Exactly. So they weren't put out of jobs. No. You mentioned there's more programmers now than ever before, and they're giving their work away for free. So open source be applied?
No, they're not really giving their work away for free.
There's more to this question. Can the methodologies and concepts around open source be applied to the news industry, and if so, in what ways?
That's why I mentioned it. I mean, they're giving something away for free, and we all do that, right? Back in the shrink wrap day when, products, that was considered revolutionary, by the way, and radical and extreme and had no future. I mean, all that kind of stuff. Because before that, software was sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was sold on the organizational level to corporations. The idea of an individual buying a license to a piece of software was unheard of. What they were selling then versus what they were giving away the use of the software, right? Yeah. So when you have open source, yeah, you find something to charge for because that's what you pay the bills with. Who cares how you pay the bills? That's sort of the conceptual leap that the news industry has yet to make. Is it really you're insisting on making your money in a very specific way, okay? And anything that's off of that formula challenges integrity or can't work for a variety of different reasons. But yet the answer, whatever it is, if you stop and think about it dispassionately, is going to involve breaking one of those rules or more than one of those rules. And it worked out okay for the software industry, and God knows there might be another barrier the software industry has to go through yet again, you know? It will go through it if it has to. As, by the way, all the complaining in the op-ed pages that the news industry does not change the fact that it still has to go through this transition. It still does. You can pretend that your op-eds mean something, but they don't.
I would answer your question in a slightly different way, Daniel. The motivations of people who contribute to open source projects, usually for no money, not always, are that if we all work together and collaborate, we'll have this new thing that we can all use, and not only the people who worked on it can use it, but anybody can use it. And that notion of producing a public good that will actually be used by lots of people who don't even know how it was produced is part of what motivates people to contribute, because it's kind of cool.
But that's the hype, Jay. There's that's only sometimes. But
important notion.
It's important, but there's another one to consider. There's a lot of times people choose to go open source because it wipes out their competitors. It's a very strong competitive tactic.
So in that sense, in the news industry,
right?
If you are open source, you can get better coverage.
Wait a minute. The analog, I'm sorry for interrupting, but the analog in the news industry is exactly what I was saying to your question before, which is open the doors and let anybody contribute. That's the theory of open source.
Right.
It says anybody gets to contribute. And if you don't let them contribute, they'll fork you. Now, if you don't know what fork means, you need to learn that, okay? It's where you give up the power to control, right? And so the problem that in the news industry would be, if you let me write alongside David Carr in the New York Times, which I'm dying to do, I would pay to do that, okay? To have a little space, maybe one-tenth of the space David Carr gets to talk about the future of the media industry. If you let me do that, then you build me up by doing that, you run the risk that the Washington Post might pick up my stuff, right? You don't have an exclusive on me, right? That's what forking would be here. Well, that's an application of people come back to places that send them away. Because if you become known as the place where the authoritative people come to debate the world that we live in, they can't touch you. That's why everybody goes to Google, and that's why their biggest asset is the fact that everybody goes to Google, right? So whoever decides to embrace this model and does it really, really well, I don't think the Huffington Post does do it well, whoever does it is going to win. And that's what's sitting there waiting for you. So part of that is to have a great Twitter, a great news system of the future. You need to have great technology, but you also need to let go of this idea that you need to put witnesses, pay witnesses to be there. Because the witnesses are there. The question is, can you bring those witnesses into your system, into your product?
We're out of time. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Hey, hang up the phone. Who's ever doing the Blog Talk Radio thing?
Okay, you got it.
Hang it up. You did? Awesome.
Thank you.
Good job, everybody.
Okay.
Well done. Yeah. Well done. Works fine.
All right. But I want to be on here.